This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Conflict, it's a part of living with others. When it escalates into full-blown war, it reaches beyond those who are fighting. It reaches into otherwise peaceful houses, into art and philosophy. It shapes lives and creates a personal history. Today, we're going to explore some of the ways war impacts us all, not just the soldiers and politicians, but those that stay at home, too. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. The theme of today's show is war. Lola Clyde's father moved to the Palouse region of the Inland Northwest in 1880, 20 years before she was born. Her father came to the remote region of Idaho as a missionary. Lola was born in 1900. She graduated with honors from the University of Idaho, then promptly married Earl Clyde in 1928. That was all after the war, World War I. Lola Clyde recorded her history orally in the 1970s for the Latah County Historical Society. Part of her oral history is captured in a new book by Susan Armitage and Laurie Mercier. It's called Speaking History, Oral Histories of the American Past, 1865 to Present. At a reading at Book People in Moscow, Idaho, Sue Armitage read Lola Clyde's personal history of how World War I affected her young years as a farm daughter in north central Idaho.
In 1916, they ran Woodrow Wilson for president on the platform, "He kept us out of war." And then he'd hardly been reelected when we declared war. And here's something interesting I remember so well the day war was declared in April. I went to school that morning, and on the blackboard they had a big sign up, "The United States enters the war, so many 100,000 men are called." And I went into the history class, and fine old Reverend Morse was the teacher, and he had the morning spokesman review there. He held up his hands, and they were kind of shaking, and he said to me, "Lola, would you read the President's Declaration of War?" And I read it through, and I can remember it just like yesterday, those closing words. Wilson said, "The time has come," I read, "when America is privileged to spend her blood for those principles that gave her birth. God helping her, she can do no other." That was his declaration of war. And one of the boys who sat there and listened, and of the boys who sat there and listened that morning, two of them were to die. Holt Cushing died on the Italian front, and Jewett Barnes in the Argonne Forest. And I had entered high school with 110 kids, and I graduated with a class of 40. And there were only 12 boys in the class. All the rest of them had gone to the war. Out of 120, half of them maybe had been boys, and there were 12 boys in the graduating class. The rest of them were all in the war, And then the interviewer asks her about anti-German sentiment here during the First World War. And he asks, "What have you heard about or seen during that time?" She says, "I remember when they smashed out store windows in Uniontown that said Kraut on it. And kraut on the window. Nobody would eat sauerkraut. Throw the kraut out. They were Germans. And all that was pretty vile, you know. I remember even the great Williamson store, he went in and gathered up everything that was made in Germany and had a big bonfire in the middle of the street, you know. Although he had many good German friends all over the county that had helped him make him rich. And there was all that went on, you know, and some people changed their names. And if it was a German name, we'll just change our name. We don't want anything to do with it." And there was lots of that, just that kind of hysteria going on. "I saw there were some boys that got draft deferments for this and that other reason, and they rode them on a rail, and they took off their clothes and tarred and feathered some of them. Some of them, as old men dying, still resented and remembered those violent episodes." The interviewer asked, "This deferment business, this was German boys who didn't have to go into the army?" "That's right. Some of them said their fathers were sick and dying, and their father had so much land they had to stay home and farm it for them, and they got what they called them farm deferments. And a lot of those men felt badly later because they didn't share in the great adventure that the other boys had had. And there was great resentment against them. A lot of them stayed home and married the belle of the town, you know, and didn't have to go to war, and all the other kids resented that and held it against them. Even after they all got to be old men, they still remembered. You hadn't gone, and you chickened out. But this actual beating of these fellows, did that actually happen? Oh, yes, that happened here, too. Would that be mostly in the county or Moscow? In Moscow, I think the Saturday night business, you know, and like at dances, they get a few drinks, and then they were looking for fights, you know. Can you actually remember hearing of anyone tarred and feathered here? Yes, I know of one case they tarred and feathered him and rode him on the rail. I knew him later in life, too. And he said if he had to do it all over again, he would have gone. He would have been glad to have gone, but his father, he was the only boy among a bunch of girls. And the father and mother both cried so and took on so that he asked for a farm deferment, though he was able. He was of German descent. Were these people that he knew, the people, that is, who tarred and feathered him? Oh, yes. Boys he'd grown up with, yes, yes. And of course there'd been some drinking, too, you know. And in the heat of it all, you know how these things go. He didn't live to be a very old man, so it was all answered for him then. It was all answered, but I do know that he told me in later life that he was sorry that he hadn't gone. He said, I missed that wonderful experience. I wouldn't have done it myself, but my folks, my father and my mother, both were so set. Interviewer asks, it's my impression of it that the German people were expected to be super patriotic more than anyone else. Yes, some of them had to bend over backwards. In fact, when they sold war bonds, they'd go out to these German farmers, you know, and just put them right on the spot. They'd made fortunes and say, we expect you to buy so many thousands worth of war bonds. And they did. Lots of them went all out, as you say, to prove their patriotism. They didn't want anything to do with this war, but a lot of them were, they'd been brought up, Germany was their home country. This was just a temporary thing here, but their homes and their loyalty were back in Germany. And there was some of that, all right, but they were among the older people. Interviewer asked, they were actually, do you think some of them actually hoped to go to Germany someday? And she says, I think maybe they had planned maybe to go back someday, but they had closer ties. They were older people. The old folks that had come maybe half grown from Germany, and they always thought, we'll make a fortune in America and go back to the homeland. And that was hard on them, I know.
Sue Armitage read from the book she co-authored with Laurie Mercier, Speaking History, Oral Histories of the American Past, 1865 to Present. The reading was at Book People in Moscow, Idaho. Installment number 2, War and Art. Otto Dix was a German artist, born in the late 1800s. He had just started studying art and was taken with the philosophy of Nietzsche when World War I broke out. Otto Dix joined up, became a German soldier. Linda Lewick explored Otto Dix's art, his definition of masculinity, and his philosophy as it changed through his art. Specifically, she studied his self-portraits. Installment number 2 is Linda Lewick's presentation at the Art of Gender Conference at Idaho State University in February 2010.
The German artist Otto Dix, who served on both the Eastern and Western fronts during World War I, embraced Friedrich Nietzsche's view that war is a natural phenomenon and part of life. Indeed, he saw it as the ultimate expression of the will to live. Later on, these views would cause Dix to have to justify what for many seemed a glorification of war. He did so by stressing his need to experience all aspects of life, both the best and the worst. In an interview in the 1960s, shortly before his death, Dix admitted, quote, "War was a dreadful business, but nevertheless very powerful. I couldn't possibly miss it. In order to know something about men, you must have seen them in this uncontrolled state." This statement not only sheds light on Dix's view of war, but also perhaps reveals something about his notion of masculinity. Dix is most known for his realist paintings of the 1920s, considered part of the Neue Sachlichkeit movement, or New Objectivity as we call it, which scholars have alternately placed within the broader context of either German Expressionism or German Post-Expressionism. These works, such as The Scat Players of 1919 here, and Prague Street, also known as War Cripples of 1920, display a direct engagement with the degenerate situation in post-war Germany during the early Weimar Republic, and offer a harsh visual protest against war and the deplorable post-war social conditions, which led to Dix's continued controversial status as an artist. However, since Dix was only 23 when he volunteered for military duty in 1914 and had just begun his formal artistic training a few years earlier, I suggest the years immediately preceding and during World War I are the crucial period in which Dix formulated his masculine identity, what it meant to him to be a man, and more specifically, what it meant to him to be a male artist. In this paper, I will consider how Otto Dix defined himself as a male artist, how he both formulated and embodied his masculine identity in his various self-portraits of the World War I period. Of particular concern is how Dix developed his conceptions of masculinity and creativity during wartime, and especially in relation to his ideas about war, which I argue were in turn profoundly informed by his reading and understanding of Nietzsche. The self-portraits under consideration, painted between 1913 and 1918, not only reveal a range of stylistic tendencies and treatments, but also the range of Nietzschean ideas that influenced Dix's definition of masculinity. At the outbreak of war in 1914, Dix, like many of his compatriots, joined up voluntarily and was assigned to a field artillery regiment in Dresden. Early in 1915, he was moved to the nearby town of Bautzen to train as a heavy machine gunner, and in the autumn of that year, he volunteered to go to the front. He was sent to the Western Front in northern France, where he took part in the autumn campaign in Champagne. In 1916, he was on the Somme in France, where he took part in several battles before being moved to Flanders. In the summer and autumn of 1917, he was in Russia on the Eastern Front, and by February 1918, he was back in France for several major battles. In the autumn of that year, after the failure of the German offensive and after the Allies had begun to mount their own massive attack, he volunteered to be trained as a pilot, which was actually a new thing at that time. In November, he was moved to Schneiderbühl in Silesia to begin that training, and it was there that he heard of the armistice and was released from the army. He was back home in Gera in Germany by Christmas. Wounded at least once during the war, Dix achieved the rank of Vice Sergeant Major and was awarded the Iron Cross, the Friedrich August Medal, and the SV Medal with Swords. To judge from the evidence of both his statements and his works, Nietzsche's philosophy was by far the most important intellectual influence on Dix from 1911 until his death in 1969. It is almost entirely thanks to his discovery of Nietzsche that Dix, a working-class boy, then engaged on a thoroughly mundane training at the Dresden School of Arts and Crafts, was able to break away from the narrow worldview of his upbringing and to take part in the exciting intellectual adventure which swept Europe in the years just before the First World War. In Self-Portraits of 1914, Dix presents himself in several views, but all dark, Byronic, even diabolic. They show the artist as a brooding force with steely gaze and smoldering intensity, a young man who is about to explode onto the scene. It is a work of supreme, not to mention arrogant, self-confidence. The artist writes his name boldly in red in the center of the composition. Like many other works painted at this time, the painting is imbued with Nietzschean ideas of the power the individual has to change his own destiny and the destiny of others by the exercise of his own will. In many ways, it is a counterpart to another self-portrait Dix painted in 1913, self-portrait as smoker. This shows the artist seated, smoking, in front of a wall of his own paintings. Here, too, the face is lit up by a red light, and the arrogance of the stare and plumes of smoke that issue from his mouth give a hellish tinge to the subject. Likewise, there is a correspondence between the various aspects of the artist's imagination as embodied in the wall of paintings and the various views of the artist's head. Dix was just 23 years old when war was declared in August 1914. He volunteered immediately, fired less by patriotic sentiment than by the intensity and range of the experience it promised. In the interview not long before he died, he recalled, quote, "I had to go to war. I had to live through it. I had to experience what it was like when someone near me was suddenly hit by a bullet and fell. I am such a realist. I had to see it all with my own eyes. The hunger, the fleas, the mud, the sitting in one's pants with fear. To be crucified, to experience the deepest abyss of life. If you want to be a hero, you also have to affirm the shit. Only through being there and experiencing for yourself can you become a hero." End quote. In 1963, while discussing art, religion, and war with his friends, Dix similarly insisted, quote, "I have to plumb all life's depths myself. That is why I went to war. That is why I volunteered in the first place," end quote. And in a 1961 interview, he claimed, quote, "War is simply something so very animalistic. You see, before doing the early pictures, I had the feeling that one side of reality hadn't been portrayed yet at all, ugliness," end quote. Such statements reveal the view Dix held as a young man that war is a natural phenomenon unleashed by the forces of human aggression. Once again, the source of these ideas is found in Nietzsche. Dix began to read Nietzsche in 1911, and by 1914 he owned 7 of the philosopher's works in the cheap pocket editions that were published between 1906 and 1908. These editions, including The Gay Science, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and the posthumously published notes entitled The Will to Power, ultimately led to Nietzsche's adoption as a cult figure by German youth before and during the First World War. For this generation throughout Europe, Nietzsche meant quite simply modernity and the spirit of the 20th century. Although his philosophy defies succinct summary, the main aspects of Nietzsche's thought that Dix seems to have identified with at this point were the acknowledgement of the collapse of traditional belief systems, the infamous death of God that we all know of, in the wake of 19th century positivism and recent scientific and psychological discoveries, the rejection of Schopenhauer's nihilistic pessimism, which had dominated so much 19th century thought, and the idea that the highest point of self-realization could be attained through the ecstatic Dionysian affirmation of life, with all its suffering and joy, embodied in the concept of the Übermensch, or usually translated as Superman. According to Nietzsche, any activities or emotions that can lead to the experience of intense feelings are to be actively pursued. Among the most powerful of these, he claimed, are music, singing, dancing, sexual excitement, making love, giving birth, hatred, fighting, and war. Significantly, the figure whom Nietzsche singles out as having the greatest potential to achieve his higher self, also expressed by Nietzsche as the will to power, is the artist creator. Closely based on the dramatic forward thrust of his 1912 bust of Friedrich Nietzsche — this bust is actually now missing, it's believed that it was destroyed in World War II by the Nazis — Dix's first wartime self-portrait as soldier of 1914, shows how literally he identified with the Superman concept. Rapidly executed in oil on paper, the work exudes an extraordinary degree of raw energy and passionate intent. Heightening the tense, twisted pose with dynamic slashes and swirls of reds, yellows, blacks, and whites, Dix celebrates his newly shaven head like a primeval warrior. Far from experiencing the mobilization process as a brutal erosion of his individuality and his creativity, as did Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, George Grosz, and many of their contemporaries, the boldly displayed signature and date beside his head transforms the image into a potent manifesto of Dix's tense but enthusiastic anticipation of the danger ahead. The mood echoes closely the following passage from Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which Dix took together with his Bible to war. Quote, "The man consummating his life dies his death triumphantly, surrounded by men filled with hope and making solemn vows. To die thus is the best death, but the second best is to die in battle and to squander a great soul. In your death, your spirit and virtue should glow like a sunset glow round the earth." End quote. This self-portrait is a celebration of strength and violence verging on savagery. It can be seen as the quintessential image of war, proclaiming the necessity of the struggle and the intoxication of destruction with no remorse or regrets. Like Nietzsche, Dix conceived of the world as a monster of strength, a force beyond the categories of good and evil, which gives birth and devours in an eternal cycle of being and cessation. This cycle, however, is not some blindly arbitrary fate to which one must submit fatalistically. Rather, it is precisely what makes eternal rejuvenation possible at every moment, and thus the ability to say yes, even to death and destruction. Or to quote Dix's own words, "One has to be able to say yes to the forms human existence takes and always will take. The exceptional situations show the human being in all its grandeur, but also in all its depravity, indeed its brutishness." End quote. On the verso of the sheet, also in oil, Dix gives the other aspect of his military persona in Self-Portrait with Artillery Helmet of 1914. Now in full ceremonial uniform, his body has shrunk into the stiff formality of a traditional three-quarter portrait pose. His face, ashen yet flushed, is scarcely distinguishable from the purple-gray surround and is completely dominated by the gaudy gold trim of his Prussian helmet. The Dionysian heroism imaged on the other side has given way to the reality of being a soldier, anonymous and now showing apprehension. Despite his youth and attraction to the war as an experience of the unknown, Dix was not unaware of the horror of war, the appalling daily chronicle of which he later produced numerous drawings and etchings. Echoing Nietzsche's scornful dismissal of art for art's sake in The Will to Power, Dix was clearly struck by the idea of the modern artist as a psychologist-philosopher, able through his own particularly intense form of instinctual intoxication to unmask illusion and self-delusion in the world around him and to reveal it in all its unvarnished, even ugly, truth. From here it is but a short step to what is many people's major problem when confronted by a Dix painting, his deliberate use of ugliness. Interestingly, Dix marked many aphorisms in which Nietzsche criticizes the sentimentality of romantic art, as well as what he deems the falseness of classical taste and beauty, because of its subjective nature and because it smothers the object which gives rise to it with a charm that is determined by the association of various judgments concerning beauty, which, however, are quite alien to the essence of the particular object. Clearly identifying with Nietzsche's insistence that nothing is ugly but degenerate man, Dix focuses on the moral justification of truthfulness in art, as in the following passage in The Will to Power. Quote, "To represent terrible and questionable things is, in itself, the sign of an instinctive power and magnificence in the artist. He doesn't fear them. There is no such thing as a pessimistic art. Art affirms." End quote. Hence Dix's use of disturbing or offensive subject matter, his use of distortion at times bordering on the grotesque, and his often harsh, strident colors must be seen as a Nietzschean-inspired aesthetic strategy intended to force both the artist and the viewer to confront issues and feelings in a critical, detached manner. Self-Portrait as Mars, the apotheosis of himself as a 20th century god of war, was painted while Dix was still training as a heavy machine gunner near Dresden in spring 1915. The formal detachment of the composition is based on a traditional three-quarter profile pose combined with the dynamic simultaneity of futurism. Dix's grimly determined jaw is keyed into a chaotic centrifugal composition in which his boldly faceted uniform, ablaze with silver star-shaped badges, is interpenetrated with fragmented buildings, rearing horses, blasted battlefield landscapes, and the grotesque faces of dying men. Using the futurist idea of synthesizing perceptions and memories to evoke states of mind and emotions, Dix conveys the myriad fantasies about war, simultaneously flooding his imagination. The heavy impasto of the surface and the strident red, yellow, and black contrasts further intensify the sense of frenetic chaos. In one of the most compelling renderings of the Dionysian affirmation of life through suffering and destruction, Dix again imagines himself as the Nietzschean Superman. Thus it comes as no surprise to find him underlining the following words in Zarathustra's prologue, where the concept of the Superman is first introduced. Quote, "One must have chaos within one to give birth to a dancing star," end quote. Nietzsche's Dionysian principles of chaos, destruction, and rebirth, the latter represented as a dancing star, are interwoven here and embodied in the Wheel of Life motif. Dix included a spoked wheel near his shoulder in the foreground, creating a circular motion that is repeated throughout the composition. For both Nietzsche and Dix, chaos within the self is the key to growth and creativity. Thus, Dix portrays himself here as the perpetrator of the destruction and transformation. Discussing his ideas of Dionysian man and transformation, Nietzsche wrote in Twilight of the Idols, quote, "The Dionysian man ignores no signal from the emotions. He possesses to the highest the instinct for understanding and divining, just as he possesses the art of communication to the highest degree. He enters into every skin, into every emotion. He is continually transforming himself," end quote. Nietzsche's insistence that this recurrent process of self-transformation can only be achieved by the individual working on himself lies at the root of Dix's self-portraits. Dix painted self-portrait as practice target soon after he arrived at the French front in the autumn of 1915. After just a few weeks' experience of the reality of war, the heroic mythologizing has been crudely stripped away. The ceremonial uniform and spiked Prussian helmet now replaced by field green and flat cap. The dynamic rhetoric of contrapposto has given way to the abrupt frontality of the photo on a soldier's identity card. Shifting to a naive style reminiscent of Le Douanier Rousseau, Dix now imagines himself as a target seen through the sight of a gun. He himself has become the target of his activity as a gunner. There is a poignant discrepancy between the anonymous banality of the image, the self as cannon fodder, and the vulnerability of his sensual mouth and the resignation fused with dread in his eyes. By the time he painted Soldier with a Pipe in 1918, Dix had become more interested in exploring the expressive possibilities of cubism and futurism. He had already experimented with futurism before the war, and as we have seen in 1915, had painted the futurist self-portrait as Mars. Now he made full use of futurist force lines and cubist faceting to create a dynamic image of the war, of the élan vital in action. The soldier smoking his pipe and the position of the signature and the date suggest that it is a self-portrait, becomes a vortex of power radiating out from the mouth, which is aggressively baring its teeth. It seems to return to the earlier painting of 1913, Self-Portrait as Smoker, which shows the artist as demiurge, as saturnine creator of his own world. Dix's postcards from the front, as well as the entries in his war diary, are not only first-rate documents of the period, but are also revealing in terms of autobiographical content. They shed light on the personality of an artist for whom the war was in fact the father of all things, as defined by Heraclitus. That is to say, the decisive experience in his development as a man and as an artist. Dix's unique way of dealing with the war, death, and destruction is marked by a way of thinking that centers on the basic human drives and is rooted in myth. He thematized the antagonism between human instinctual nature and the progress of civilization, with its ineffectual attempts to tame the animal in humans. He possessed the kind of sensuality and vitality that led him to search for the wild and primeval beyond the scope of historical events. Dix thought and acted without any moral or value-oriented preconceptions. He was bent on probing into that tension-filled primordiality of human nature, which had been transformed many times over in the course of socio-cultural evolution. In Kampf als inneres Erlebnis, Battle as Inner Experience, the German soldier Ernst Jünger claims that in war, the enthusiasm of manliness bursts beyond itself. Similarly, Dix suggests that the true driving force of humanity is animalistic rather than heroic. The inescapable human condition, which Dix had accepted from Nietzsche, was one of mendaciousness and animality. Thus, in the end, Dix's self-portraits are, in their precision of detail and intensity, at once highly individual and general statements about the soldier's experience, which is always essentially the same and transcends the immediate historical context. In their content, these self-portraits of an individual man reveal the general misery, suffering, and horror of war for all men, and thus, like all of Dix's greatest work, are specific and universal at the same time. Thank you.
Linda Lewick is an assistant professor of art history at Idaho State University. She studies 19th and early 20th century European art and intellectual history, particularly German modernism. This is Yin Radio. Today's theme is war and how it affects everyday lives beyond the time and place of fighting. Installment number 3. Author of Mother Speak, Susan Gallimore, collected stories from around the world from mothers and fathers of soldiers and from the soldiers themselves. Susan Gallimore's son is a soldier. That's what drew her into the study of war and into activism against war. Susan's son first went to Afghanistan, then to Iraq. She studied the U.S. military, then she went to Iraq to talk to her son about what she had learned. It was in Iraq where she started collecting stories from other parents of soldiers and victims of war. Susan has talked to people in Israel, in Palestine, to Iraqi refugees in Syria, to people in Lebanon, and of course in the United States. Susan Gallimore describes what's happening as an arc of pain that we create through U.S. policy. Susan Gallimore read from her book Mother Speak at the University of Idaho in November 2009.
And I'm going to read two little pieces. One talks about war, and I'm going to read one letter from the troop. But before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about war in general. The war to end all wars, World War I, did nothing of the sort. From 1914 to 1918, more than 65 million men mobilized. Up to 10 million men lost their lives on the battlefields, and 20 million more were wounded. The death toll for World War II was over 72 million, including about 12 million related to post-war famines in China, Indonesia, Indochina, and India. And these are often omitted from the casualty compilations because they're people that we don't really care about. They're not really on our radar. More than 25 million of these deaths were military. 40 million civilian and 5.5 million, as we know, from the Holocaust. Yet in the wars leading up to and including World War II, from 75% to 80% of riflemen did not fire their weapons, even to save their own lives or their buddies' lives. Once the U.S. military recognized this, it immediately improved training techniques to develop a reflexive quick shoot ability that improved firing rates to 90 to 95% by the time the Vietnam War happened. And this is reported by a colonel in the United States Army. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. He's also a psychologist. In the military training today, Grossman says, nearly every aspect of killing on the battlefield is rehearsed, visualized, and conditioned, combining manufactured contempt, denial, and contempt for the victim's role in society, desensitization and inhumanity, and practicing on man-shaped silhouettes. In the same period, the military also determined that youth between the ages of 18 and 20 make the best soldiers. They are easy to condition psychologically during this developmental stage when individuals establish stable personality structures and a sense of self. They're also idealistic and they're vulnerable to the siren song of patriotism. Add signing bonuses that seem like small fortunes and the perennial glamour of jumping out of helicopters, and voila, our nation has plenty of volunteers. Only in basic training do they learn that they no longer have the same civil rights as other citizens enjoy. David Chu, the Pentagon's Undersecretary for Personnel and Readiness, opined in 2005 that the government was, and this is a quote, the government was spending too much on benefits for Americans who have served in the military, and that the money would be better spent on bullets and bombs. The amounts have gotten to the point where they are hurtful, Chu said. They are taking away from the national's ability to defend itself. Deputy Assistant Director for National Security Matthew Goldberg testified before the Committee on Veterans Affairs. Depending on the future force levels deployed to OIF, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and Operation Enduring Freedom, if the Congress chooses to fully fund medical care for veterans of those operations, VA medical costs explicitly associated with these operations could total between $7 billion and $9 billion over the 10-year period 2008 through 2017. The costs of disability compensation and survivors' benefits could add another roughly $3 billion to $4 billion over the same period. So when we hear about the numbers of that the VA is putting into the vets, remember that there's a hell of a lot of numbers that they're really not counting yet. And those are the numbers that are the numbers that continue to care for the people that have been injured in these wars, but also the wars of Vietnam and the other wars, Panama and so forth, the wars that we don't hear so much about. So the numbers are amazing. The numbers are very telling, and what we're hearing about them is just a small municipal piece of it. So again, there's so much here that I want to say about the stories that I collected in these other countries. I very carefully chose people in my book that are not well known, because I believe that it's the ordinary person that's going to change this thinking of ordinary people in the world, not just in the United States. Ordinary people have an enormous amount of power, and it's in a potential stage. We really haven't begun to tap it yet. But I did want to finish with the story of Makisha. Makisha was a National Guardswoman from Oregon. And her mother was from Jordan. It was an Arabic family. And Makisha actually means in Arabic to sweep out. And this was a great, great fun when Makisha actually was in Iraq, because she didn't know what her name meant. And the Iraqi girls that she came into contact with told her. But she went to Iraq after having been promised by her recruiter that she would never be deployed, and that she would be in the United States doing work as she expected to do as a National Guardswoman. 2003, she was in Iraq. She telephoned her mother one day and she said, I don't know, I can't even tell you what's going on here. She said, I'm Arabic and here I am on the back of a Humvee shooting other Arabs. She said, I cannot show my face to any of my extended family again. Long story short, what happened to Makisha, she almost died in a helicopter crash. She became lovers with the person that she turned to in the helicopter as they went down together. The helicopter didn't crash. They became lovers briefly through this near-death experience. She got pregnant. They were not interested in continuing their relationship. She was urged, she was in Colorado, she was urged to have an abortion by her commander in George Bush's military. And she refused. And there was a lot of pressure to have this abortion. She refused to do it. She said, I have had enough to do with death, and I want to have something to do with life. So her child was born. She had a very bad injury in her leg, and she still suffers with that. And there's sometimes she goes through a thing of thinking that it might be better to have her leg amputated. She's suffering very much with a post-traumatic stress disorder. Her little boy was born. Part of his brain that deals with language is affected. He's not able to speak. He's apparently the most, I haven't seen him, but he's apparently the most beautiful child, but he's mute. He cannot talk. I like to read this letter because Makisha has gone through a very rough time. She's now beginning to come out of her shell. She stayed in her house for most of her time, taking care of her kid. She just recently started going to college in Oregon. She's now going to Oregon State. This is a letter that she wrote to her mother in May 2003, and I put it in this book because I wanted Makisha to know how she felt about things in 2003, because I know that she'll come around eventually and read this letter again. Nights here are a trip in the rainy season. Even the rain is desperate, but I feel at home as if the land holds no hostility toward me. I walked in the desert last night, and there was a pack of wild dogs barking. The moon was hidden by clouds, and as I danced in the rain, my rifle thumped and beat against my calves, and my boonie cap fell back and was held by a string against my throat. The rain fell in great big drops, and the wind whistled across the debris in the sand. Someone was out there shooting the dogs. Those are the ugly moments, interspersed with the beautiful. I heard two shots. I hope the dogs got away. If I didn't distance myself from this world, I'd be more upset than I am. I miss my dogs, my truck, my home, and my people. Yet if someone offered me a ride home tomorrow, I'd turn it down. My crew is here, and the kids need me. I have angry moments, frustration, all the usual things, but I've also found something. I cannot describe the joy I have in living. Even in the bad moments, I find something beautiful around me. I hold on to it with all my power. I may not be able to change the situations I face or the world here, but I hold true to the things that make me who I am. I will change. I will return home a different person, but I'll not let go of the joy in my life. I will not let go of my ability to find beauty in squalor. I can't explain the faith that surges through me, but I know that I will return whole. I will return whole. I will not let this tear me apart. And there were many times when I was writing this book when my heart was so broken, because there I had a kid in a military uniform, and I had all of these stories that I was bringing home to share with people, and I felt like I could really relate to Makisha. I will not let go of my ability to find beauty in squalor. I can't explain the faith that surges through me, but I know that I will return home. I will not let this tear me apart. And I think it's really, really essential that we fight this war and we understand what people are going through, and we really, really also hold out the beauty in the world and the thing that we're really fighting for, which is the beauty of the world and the beauty of the human heart and the beauty of the human soul. And everybody has that, no matter what they tell you out there about how fearful you need to be of people out in another country. You and they all share this fundamental thing, which is the most beautiful thing there is, and that's life. So hold on to that and glorify that, and don't let the other stuff tear you apart.
Susan Gallimore, she's a soldier's mother, an author, and an activist. Installment number 4, Women's Roles. Women's roles as mothers change when their sons enter the military. Cynthia Inlos says that mothers of veterans take on the role of an activist. She doesn't just mean the obvious activist that Julia Ward Howe was or that Cindy Sheehan is today, but she means that their activities in supporting their sons by default supports the systems and governments that wage war. As an example, here's Professor Inlow telling the story of Charlene Kane, a mother who needed to take care of her son Michael when his leg was amputated because of injuries he received during the Gulf War.
And so Charlene Kane comes to Washington. She helps Michael at least inch his way out of depression to begin to engage with therapy that is going to have to go on for a long time. After a month or so, the Walter Reed Hospital folks, trying to do as best they can, now remember, he's in the ward that has not had the problems. He's not in Building 18. They send him home. Okay, now what? Charlene Kane is essentially the head of a complex household. Added to that household now is a brand new young man who's had his left leg amputated. At the end of her work day, after she's, you know, helped the household get settled, and spending about 2 hours a night on Veterans Administration and Department of the Army forms, because there's no guarantee that Michael will get the series. He's going to have more operations, and then more operations. He's going to have drug therapy, and then more drug therapy. He's going to have physical therapy, and then more physical therapy. Under which benefit plan will each of those come? That's Charlene Kane's now responsibility. Michael's in no condition to handle reams of paper. And so it's going to be up to Charlene Kane to make sure that Michael gets the years of therapy and medical attention that he can get. The household certainly can't pay for it. It will have to come from one form of either Department of the Army or Veterans Administration. And if you slip between the two, you can be in big trouble. That's where we leave Charlene Kane. But for how many years will she be the activist mother of a veteran? Now, in no part of the story do we get any sense of what Charlene Kane's ideas are about war, about the current administration, about foreign policy, about political change in the Middle East. And again, in that sense, she doesn't come across as political. But is she political? Oh, yes. Because governments cannot wage wars. And I'm talking about all kinds of governments. I'm talking about the government of the Congo. I'm talking about the government of France. I'm talking about the government of Vietnam. I'm talking about every government that either prepares for war or wages war has to have women as mothers who don't think of themselves as political, but just think of themselves trying to be good mothers, carrying the burden of care of soldiers who come home.
That's Cynthia Inlow. She's a research professor at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. She specializes in the interactions of feminism, women, militarized culture, war, politics, and globalized economics in countries around the world. Cynthia Inlow spoke at the University of Idaho in April 2007. Now, for this last installment of this Yin Radio show, we go back to Sue Armitage and Laurie Mercier's book, Speaking History, Oral Histories of the American Past, 1865 to Present. Co-author Laurie Mercier reads an oral history from Jerry Casales, one of the members of the band Devo.
This is from the Experience Music Project Science Fiction Museum and Hall of Fame in Seattle. You know, it's a great institution in Seattle, and they also have a wonderful archive. And this is another example of surprising places where we found excellent interviews with musicians. And so Jerry Casale, in describing his music, also talks about how he became inspired. I'll just read the first part and the last part of this interview, where he talks about some of his first musical memories. He describes standing next to one of these huge floor-based wooden radios that were typical in homes that a lot of parents had after World War II and through the 1950s. And I think I was maybe four, and my mother would turn it to a station during the day that played mostly bad music, but there was an hour in the afternoon when they were basically playing hillbilly music. It was Ohio, after all. There was a big influx from West Virginia of people that had come from the coal mines and sought work in northeastern Ohio when that failed. So I remember hearing Frankie Lane singing Night Train, and I couldn't wait for that song. I heard it once, and then I couldn't wait to hear it again. And then Ghost Riders in the Sky. It was Tex Ritter or somebody. Those songs just drilled into my brain and gave me a nice foundation for when I first heard Elvis a few years later. But in describing the musical influences on his life before forming the band Devo, he recalled his years at Kent State and told a story that I think will interest you and certainly will interest students of history. So when you come to the really important defining moment at Kent State University that changed my life forever and ultimately sent me back to music and creating Devo, were the killings by the National Guard of the four students over the anti-war protest. Nixon decided on May 3, 1970, that he would expand the Vietnam War into Cambodia, and they did it without an act of Congress, and this was very upsetting to everybody back then. They actually believed in the Constitution and the separation of powers. They thought he had to get an okay, and he just did it, executive power. So on May 4th, Monday, the students called an impromptu rally at noon to protest the expansion of the war. But over the weekend, anticipating student unrest, the National Guard moved in, hidden in the heating plant inside the university, unbeknownst to the students, had jeeps parked about 3 miles out of town and were ready to go. And so the governor at noon declared a limited form of martial law, and he forbade protest. He made that automatically, by definition, illegal that day, so that whatever happened, the National Guard had then the rationale to do what they did. Now, you got to remember, the students protesting were 18 and 19, and the National Guardsmen were 18 and 19. That was the condition I grew up in my formative years, from just being kind of a passive, live-let-live kind of pseudo-hippie to fully aware person who had to strike out against hideous, illegitimate authority. And I was there that day. And I had become friends with two of the four students who were about to die, Jeffrey Miller and Allison Krauss. And we were all kind of being herded by the National Guard, who cut off our escape route over the front of the campus, so we had to keep going back towards the football field. And then, just like a B-movie, a second phalanx of them appeared, coming out of the heating plant, and now they've got everybody boxed in, so everyone starts running for the student parking lot. And that's when they knelt. The first row knelt, the second row stood, and they fired. And nobody thought they had live ammunition. Certainly no one even could guess that. The bayonets were scary enough. The tear gas was bad enough. But nobody thought about actual bullets. And I still remember the crack of the rifles and everything and not knowing what the hell. Nobody knew what it was. And so this massive human-animal confusion, like when Kennedy was assassinated and everybody's looking around, it sounds like a backfire. And then suddenly there's that moment, like in a bad auto accident, or like in the stylization of a Scorsese film like Raging Bull, where everything goes into slow motion. Sound blows away. You don't hear the birds anymore, the wind, the trees. And some horrible feeling in your gut is emanating out of your whole body as you realize somebody's laying there with blood coming out of them. There's smoke everywhere. Everyone's frozen and then back to live action, screaming, yelling, screaming, chaos. And you don't know what's going on, and it turns out the person 50 feet away from me laying face down on the sidewalk was Allison Krauss. And the guy down like 100 feet down the hill on the driveway where the famous picture of the girl screaming towards the sky over him, kneeling over him, that was Jeffrey Miller. And I found out that out, and at the same time we were being herded like cattle and made to sit on the grass at gunpoint, and we sat there for 2.5 hours till they figured out what to do with us. They marched us off campus single file through a line of National Guardsmen, closed the campus, I guess full curfew and martial law in the city for the next 5 days, and I can't find an explanation here verbally right now to tell you how much that changed me. But let's just say it was no more Mr. Nice Guy, especially when the papers came out the next day with the headline, Students Hurt Guardsmen.
Blood Ruby's song called Bone Garden is wrapping up this Yin Radio show. You can catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive updates about the program or make a contribution to support Yin Radio. Opening music's by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation and by me. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Cynthia Inlow's piece was produced today by Brittany Peralt. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.